From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the last job line ends service into Waukesha County this Saturday. We'll look at why the job lines were created, why they're ending, and what the future holds for mass transit in Milwaukee County. Then a film made in Milwaukee returns home after Sundance and Cannes, but it almost didn't get made at all.
2 years, I believe, into the process, we began to feel a little bit foolish because we still were not able to make the film because very few people believed in Milwaukee as a place to make a great movie.
And local musician Keith Pulvermacher explains what makes his newest album different from those that came before.
This time around with this record, it really has been spurred on by the diagnosis of my dad having cancer and really looking internally at my own life and trying to see what I can do to make a difference in the world with the music and have more purpose.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. This Saturday, the last job line bus will cease operations. After the 24th of August, the 57 will still operate in Milwaukee County, but it will no longer cross the county line into Waukesha. Meanwhile, Milwaukee County Transit System is facing a large budget shortfall and is looking to shut down even more routes than the remaining job line. We'll be focusing on regional transit over the next couple of days, but today we'll start with the job lines themselves. I'm joined now by Lake Effect's producer, Joy Powers, the executive producer of our week-long series. Hi, Joy.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I think we probably should start at the beginning. For people who may not be familiar with the job line saga, what are they?
You know, the job lines are actually a few different bus lines. I think that sometimes gets confused in this conversation. So they all operated inside of Milwaukee and Waukesha counties kind of at different times. As the name implies, they were really meant to answer what we've often called the last mile problem. So it's this issue of connecting people in Milwaukee, specifically Milwaukee Central City, to jobs over in Waukesha County. And these lines weren't just created as an initiative of the county transit systems. They were actually the result of a lawsuit. And I spoke with Allison Bussler. She's the director of public works in Waukesha County, and she explains what happened.
The ACLU, the Black Health Coalition, and MICA sued the Wisconsin Department of Transportation related to the zoo interchange project. They felt that the project didn't take into consideration the impact it would have on some disadvantaged neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. And so those two groups, the DOT and the plaintiffs, came to a settlement whereby the Wisconsin Department of Transportation would fund some transit routes of the plaintiff's choice for up to 4 years.
That was Allison Bussler. She's the director of public works in Waukesha County. So the job lines, they started actually as Route 61 and then Route 6. And earlier this year, the lines were consolidated kind of into Route 57. It was an existing bus line that was then extended into Waukesha to fill the gap that those other routes left.
So as Bussler said, these lines were funded up to 4 years, which was part of the reason why the lines were consolidated and tacked on to Route 57. We should note that although the job line into Waukesha is ending, Route 57 will continue to serve intercity riders in Milwaukee. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
But the Waukesha portion is ending. Why?
You know, there are a few explanations, and as you might guess, a lot of it boils down to money. So the state funding ran out in 2018. Tom Winter, he's from MCTS, the Milwaukee County Transit System. He spoke with us, and he's the director of schedules and planning for the system. He says these lines were never really planned to be a long-term solution.
The funding that WSTOP provided from the settlement was temporary in nature, and when it expired, something had to happen to replace that, and we have major funding issues of ourselves to deal with beyond providing a replacement for something that was temporary.
That was Tom Winter. He's from MCTS, and it's not just about the temporary funding. It's also about the line itself. So it was meant to connect a lot of people in the city to a lot of jobs in the suburbs, as we've said. But in Waukesha County, the ridership is really low. Here's Allison Bussler from Waukesha to explain.
this is maybe a misunderstanding that's going around. When you look at the ridership data in Waukesha County, there were only about 70 rides per day, or about 7% of the rides. So if you figure folks take the bus to work and home, it's about 35 people. And the subsidy of what each of those riders needed was about $18,000 annually per rider, just for that Waukesha County section. And so it's really hard to say that's a viable route.
That's a lot of money. There's no way around that. But there are still a lot of people in the community who are really sad to see this line go, especially people who were involved in the initial case. So we reached out to one of the lawyers who represented the plaintiffs in this case. His name is Dennis Grzynski, and he was able to send us this written statement, which says, quote, "The end of the job lines is sad and disappointing. People who relied on the buses to get to their jobs in Waukesha County are facing difficult obstacles in the way of keeping those jobs, and their employers will be facing greater difficulties in filling their vacancies. For many years, Sewer PAC, the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission's regional plans, have highlighted the desperate need of the region for a major increase in transit facilities and services, but state support has instead declined significantly. Moving forward, it's important that the state of Wisconsin provides greater financial support for public transit throughout the state, not just in Southeast Wisconsin. In addition, county governments, particularly in this region, need to be given the authority to enact a dedicated sales tax to support transit. That was lawyer Dennis Grzynski. He represented the plaintiffs in this initial case. And, you know, he brings up a lot of stuff that we've heard reiterated by many people who are familiar with this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. As he mentioned, these lines were meant to connect people to jobs. And although ridership has been low, there's still a legitimate problem for businesses who need employees. So I have to ask, isn't getting rid of this line going to mean fewer ways for employees to get out to those jobs?
I mean, that's a fair question. And it's true. It will be one less way for people to get out to those jobs. It's something that we're going to talk about in more depth during this series. One of our reporters, Latoya Dennis, will be looking at the impact this may have on Waukesha businesses later this week. But simply put, Bustler says that while well-intentioned, these bus lines weren't the solution that they hoped they would be.
Transit wasn't the silver bullet in this case. That could be for a variety of issues. Perhaps we don't have the density. Perhaps folks don't want to ride the bus for an hour. A lot of the jobs have certain skill set requirements. So if the job openings are for a welder, but anybody riding that bus is not a welder, well, then that's not a fit. There are other employers telling us, you know, for more entry-level positions, that they really just need someone who will show up every day on time, drug-free. And that's been a struggle. And so I think there's certain job training programs that perhaps can work on that problem as well.
And you're right. This problem of getting people to jobs in the suburbs, that hasn't gone away. And we'll be talking about solutions to this last mile issue again later on in this series.
Well, we're talking about the end of the job lines, but this news is coming at a time when the Milwaukee County Transit System is having to make a lot of cuts to services. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so MCTS is facing a budget deficit of almost $6 million for 2019. If nothing changes, it's planning to cut 6 freeway flyer routes, 4 U-Bus routes, 5 shuttles, and Route 52 in order to balance the budget. That last one, upsetting for me, Route 52 goes near my house. Christina Hoffman, she's the director of marketing and communications for MCTS. She says the shortfall has a lot to do with the way the state funds counties and municipalities.
Over the past decade, Milwaukee County taxpayers have been sending more and more money to the state, but the funding that the county receives back has been flat or has even declined. So we can look at the state as being part of the problem.
And she says that even with a change in leadership in Madison, you know, things aren't really going to get better right away.
It's just not enough to fill the gap. Right now, we're receiving state revenue that's lower now than it was in 2010. And meanwhile, the trend across the country is expanding transit, but Milwaukee's falling behind. You know, it's not surprising that we're in this position when we don't have the funding to support it.
And as both Hoffman and Winter point out, limiting funding, it reduces access to transit and ultimately it reduces ridership.
So transit in the area is facing a lot of obstacles, and the end of the job line will be upsetting for the people who are currently depending on it. But the 57 isn't the only way to get from the city of Milwaukee into the suburbs, isn't that right?
Yeah, you know, there are definitely other lines that connect Milwaukee to the suburbs, and there are specifically lines that connect people from Milwaukee County to jobs in Waukesha County. Here's Allison Bussler again from Waukesha.
Fortunately, there is some areas that transit is working quite well for this issue. The Gold Line in Milwaukee County visits UWM up Wisconsin Avenue into Blue Mound. Waukesha County funds the Brookfield Square extension. And so that route is very successful. We have about 30 riders on average that ride that bus, as opposed to the Route 61, which had two or three riders. We have another route that starts in downtown Waukesha, but then goes to Brookfield, and that has about 19 riders per hour on average. And because we have folks in Waukesha County, too, that need help getting to work through transit. And so we're focusing on those areas that are really working and then continuing to explore other ideas on how we might be able to address this issue.
And what are some of the other solutions that Milwaukee and Waukesha counties are looking at to link up their services?
You know, one of the things they have in the works, which both counties are really excited about, it's the East-West Bus Rapid Transit Project. This would essentially create a designated lane for the bus, as well as some other features that should make the bus faster and more reliable. So here's Tom Winter from MCTS to explain.
This is the BRT, the Bus Rapid Transit Project, primarily from where we are downtown out to the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center. It's very high-frequency service. It's branded vehicles, it's off bus payment, you pay at the station itself. So it's high frequency, high speed.
And this is something Waukesha is hoping will be an opportunity to connect their services in a way that could encourage more ridership. Bussler says they're also working on some smaller things with MCTS, like creating an app that would have a few different transit maps available to users to make it easier for people to connect from Milwaukee County buses to Waukesha County buses.
So as you mentioned earlier, later this week, we're going to be talking about some of the solutions to the last mile problem. What else are we going to look at in this series?
So tomorrow, our producer, Audrey Nowakowski, she's going to really dig into the history of cross-county transit initiatives in the area. Some of our reporters from the WUWM newsroom will be talking with the people who use the buses, and we'll get the perspective of businesses in Waukesha, what the needs are there, and how they might be answered.
Terrific. Joy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We heard from Tom Winter, the Director of Schedules and Planning, and Christina Hoffman, the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Milwaukee County Transit System. Allison Bussler is the Director of Public Works in Waukesha County. Now we're going to revisit a Bubbler Talk segment that Joy produced last year on high-speed rail. It's another aspect of mass transit that has had a rocky history here.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I don't just want jobs that are created in short term based upon a government subsidy. I want jobs that are long term and sustainable. And the most sustainable jobs, 75% to 80%, are likely to come from small businesses, not from employers getting government subsidies.
I'm Joy Powers, and that was Governor Walker speaking to reporters in 2010 about an issue that has been on the minds of many Wisconsinites, including one who wrote into Bubbler Talk. They were curious about why there isn't a high-speed rail line connecting Milwaukee with other cities in Wisconsin and the region. The answer is complicated, but simply put, there was a plan for a higher-speed rail line, but Governor Walker was against it. Rob Henkin from the Wisconsin Policy Forum first came to the state in the 90s to work for a group that focused on transit. He explains the origins of this higher-speed rail plan, which came out in 2004.
There was a very carefully laid out plan, a Midwest Regional Rail Initiative, that essentially saw Chicago as being the center of sort of in a wheel, so a spoke approach, where there would be higher speed rail connections between Chicago and Milwaukee, heading then west to Madison, so connecting Milwaukee and Madison and going then all the way to Minneapolis, higher speed rail between Chicago and St. Louis, higher speed rail to Detroit, and throughout the Midwest. And once upon a time, you had 9 Midwestern states that were all on board, no pun intended, to actually try to lobby together for the federal government to allocate federal resources to do this whole Midwest rail initiative.
And they succeeded. At the time, Governor Doyle was able to secure $810 million earmarked by the Obama administration to help create parts of this system, specifically a line connecting Milwaukee and Madison. But there was a problem. Kevin Mews from the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission explains.
When Governor Scott Walker was a candidate, he made one of his platform planks stopping that project. So when he was elected, actually Governor Doyle stopped the project the day after the election in 2010.
During his campaign, Walker made it clear he thought the project would be a waste of money. There were other transit issues he thought were more pressing, like fixing Wisconsin's, quote, crumbling roads and bridges, as he put it in 2010. The operating bill for the train was projected to be $7.5 million a year, which he felt was too high a burden. For perspective, Wisconsin's DOT budget for 2015 to 2017 allocates more than $3 billion for roads. According to Kevin Mews, there's a common misconception about transit's ability to make money.
No mode of transportation pays for itself, but for some reason we have a perception that the automobile does, whereas transit doesn't, which is inaccurate, but that certainly is the perception.
At one time, mass transit was profitable, but that's no longer the case.
50, 60 years ago, you had private companies running rail systems and able to make money. Some argue that because we have so heavily subsidized highway building and automobile usage, that meant the private sector couldn't make money running rail systems or any type of transit systems.
The money earmarked for a higher speed rail in Wisconsin was given away. Other states in the Midwest accepted the money and used it to update their rails and make them more efficient. It's unclear what a higher speed rail could mean for Milwaukee, but Mews says it really comes down to connectivity.
You're providing the connectivity that helps the economy move and makes it easier for people, in this case, to move around and access jobs more easily, shop more easily, access education more easily, which is good for the economy generally.
The question now, what will it take to get a higher speed rail system in Wisconsin? The answer, a confluence of political will, funding, and a plan. And we already have the last part.
The Department of Transportation still has a passenger rail plan.
It's called Connections 2030 and was first developed in 2009 before Walker took office.
That passenger rail plan has basically two dominant corridors from Chicago to the Twin Cities, connecting Milwaukee and Madison and communities in between, and then from Chicago to Green Bay, including connecting to Milwaukee and the Fox Cities. They've got specific plans. That would be 110-mile-an-hour service, so many trips per day. It's all spelled out in the plan. The political piece of it is a real challenge to figure out what the future holds.
Making these kinds of plans a reality takes a lot of politicians across municipalities, state lines, and political divides coming together to make them happen. Our current political climate may make that seem unlikely, but Rob Henkin says it could happen, and the federal government may once again want to earmark funds for the initiative.
Since the Trump administration came in, there's been talk about infrastructure maybe being the issue where the Republicans and the Democrats could agree. And now, in the wake of the elections, there's talk again that infrastructure may be one of the top agenda items in Washington. And if that's the case, might it include a high-speed rail component again? Hard to say. I guess there's a slight possibility.
But if it isn't part of the federal plan, then Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota would have to come together to raise the funds, which Henkin says could be prohibitively expensive. The person who asked the initial question that started this piece wanted to know two things: why there isn't a high-speed rail in Wisconsin, and whether or not it was something that would ever come to the state. And the short answer to both is political will. We don't have one because politicians decided it wasn't important. We could have one if politicians decide it is important. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
From Milwaukee to Sundance to Cannes to Milwaukee, we talk with the creators of the film Give Me Liberty ahead of its local premiere at the Oriental Theater this Saturday. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We first spoke with writer and producer Alice Austin and filmmaker Kirill Mikhanovsky in 2014. They were just beginning a Kickstarter campaign to make their Milwaukee-inspired feature film, Give Me Liberty. The film is a day-in-the-life story that follows Vic, a young Russian-American who drives a handicapped transport van in the city and shares an apartment with his grandfather. Austin Mikhanovsky wanted their dark comedy to be raw, authentic, and reflective of Milwaukee, and also a meditation on the American dream. And the film itself has become the realization of a dream after almost not getting made. It's played at the Sundance Film Festival and Cannes, and now comes home for its Milwaukee premiere at the Oriental Theater this Saturday. Austin and Mikhanovsky joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski before they left for Sundance in January to talk about Give Me Liberty and how they hope it will be a catalyst for more filmmaking here. Mikhanovsky started by explaining why they refused to make the film in any other city.
Well, from the get-go, we wanted to make not just a movie, but also a world-class movie that could compete with the bigger films out there, because the competition is pretty fierce. There are thousands of films, especially today with the technology. And to make something that is truly outstanding and gets picked up for distribution, it's not easy. And especially in Milwaukee, because there's no industry, film industry. It's a wonderful city. It's a wonderful town. It's growing. It's expanding.
And that's shifting. I mean, that's beginning to shift with No Studios and the work Jonathan Jackson has done through Milwaukee Film, and they've been great supporters of what we're doing. But it still is like a hurdle. I think we were unwilling to lower our understanding of where the film could be. And you know, that required just a great deal of tenacity on both of our parts.
It's a part of our ethos, and it has very little to do with perfectionism per se. It's really not willing to do anything below our standards.
One of the things that the film reveals is this craft, like this understanding of, because a lot of people go out and they shoot movies, and it's really easy now. You know, it's digital. You can just go out and make a movie. And there is a certain craft that is lost, and it's a craft that's a little more alive in Europe. I think it was really gratifying in the last couple of weeks to see the film embraced so profoundly by some Europeans who really know cinema, and see that they recognized it as, you know, as cinema. It was really, really exciting.
We wrote this script rather fast, and it almost immediately got amazing response. With the first iteration, was an 8-day plot involving probably close to 100 of characters. People loved it. The reaction was amazing. And it was inspired by Milwaukee, made for Milwaukee as the main character. There were a lot of attempts to take it anywhere else. We stuck to our guns. And 2 years, I believe, into the process, we began to feel a little bit foolish because we still were not able to make the film, because very few people believed in Milwaukee as a place to make a great movie. And obviously not a lot of funding is available really in Milwaukee, aside from the wonderful Brico Foundation grant that we received from the Milwaukee Film
Organization. Well, and there were some people who along the way helped us and supported us.
Right, exactly. You know, no. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a number of people with great vision for the city through cinema, because we believe that cultural life can be boosted through the budding film industry in the city. It's obviously a long-term process. It can take a little time, but we always saw ourselves and the film as a catalyst.
We had this big, incredible script, and people were kind of having trouble hooking into it. And part of it was, what's Milwaukee? What is Milwaukee really?
Nobody has.
And all of a sudden, we made it into a 24-hour timeline, and it just landed. It clicked with everyone. So we had very, very well-known actors reaching out to be in the movie. It became very funny. You know, the process became very funny because we had started with this whole idea of authenticity. And we could easily have been swept up in this notion that we really had to cast a very well-known British actor as a young Russian-born 25-year-old immigrant with a Russian family. And I think that was a really close call for the project, because we were working with partners who really wanted a very circumscribed film. They wanted it to be sort of very square. There's a French word, it's carré, which is really a great word for what they were trying to do with it. And we were getting notes that we're not pushing it in the right direction creatively. And Kirill, as a director, is, you know, he takes the script and then he is on set, and there's a great deal of freedom that has to be there. And I understood that. And I understood that freedom is partly this energy and this capacity to live in the moment and really capture things on film. And that as his creative partner, that was something I really needed to support and we really had to do.
Do you think that Kickstarter, because so many projects, I mean, with the advent of tech that everyone is accessible to for films, Kickstarter is a very common way to make a project happen. Do you also think that Kickstarter is right now the best way to make a film more authentic?
No. I mean, for us, Kickstarter was a way of just getting going, and it was wonderful.
Getting the word out.
It helped a lot, and it gave us some seed money.
To run the operation,
to be able
to travel and pitch the film. And we were incredibly thrifty with that amount and very responsible. And I believe actually most of it actually went into our small budget film.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the reality is that film financing is difficult anywhere. Independent film financing is difficult. I'm really hopeful because I think there's movement in Milwaukee that film will be seen as a viable enterprise here because, you know, as the city's trying to expand different kinds of businesses and attract different kinds of businesses, because it is, you know, it is a money-making endeavor. A lot of people do make money in film. Independent films ultimately in the States have to be financed. And we ended up, you know, financing the film primarily outside of the city, outside of Milwaukee. We were actually, because we made this decision to make the movie. And we didn't have all of our financing in place, which is normally never how I would do something.
We basically looked at each other in October of 2017, and there was an option of not making the film, theoretically speaking, because that's where we were. We were left high and dry. And we understood one critical thing, that if we didn't make the film, we would be ashamed of ourselves for the rest of our lives. We would not be able to look in the eyes of those who had trusted us with their money, including Kickstarter. We would be clearly ashamed to look in the eyes of those who stalled, who basically put their lives on hold for us. So whenever it comes to are you happy with the fact that you made this film or it's recognized by Sundance, et cetera, first and foremost, we're joyful because we're able to deliver on the promise to make this film. And finally, you know, when people found out that we made it, that we came through with the movie, that it's recognized, I think a lot of people whose lives were not dependent on it were relieved. They were relieved not to be disappointed in us. And that is an amazing feeling.
Well, the other thing that happened is we brought this cast together, and it's a completely improbable cast.
Right.
So we found these people, all of whom are profoundly charismatic. And the most remarkable thing is they bonded and had the relationships in real life that they have in the movie.
Well, have the that relationship built and to have so much weighed on, well, not simple act of completing the film, but having the decision, we need to make this. And as you said, coming through on that promise for people outside of Sundance, outside of everything that's happened. But now that the screening at Sundance is coming up, are you nervous about what that effect is?
I'm only nervous about one thing, because we got back from Paris and landed, and I had an urgent email from Sundance in my inbox that said, hey, we can't read your CRU drive. And I was, of course, like panicked immediately, and we, you know, scrambled, and they do have CRU drives they can read. But so the only thing is really that I'm nervous about at this point is when that mounts on screen and it's all working, we're good.
Yeah. What do you anticipate audience reaction? And then also just, I mean, there's a lot of stories of things that screen at Sundance and then all of a sudden their production companies, the directors, everything highlighted. So are you expecting that? Are you prepared for that? Or what is your hope with this experience of getting this film screened for a wider audience after so much trouble to simply remain and stick to your guns and to just finish the project in the first place?
Making a movie is the hardest thing, you know, on earth, but actually getting it to
be seen,
you know, in its perfect iteration, to be screened. Actually, the hardest thing about making a movie is getting the tickets to its premiere by the people who made it.
By the people who made it, because
Alice just spent about a month and a half of her life just kind of just wasted making sure everybody got a ticket. But I don't know about Alice. I'm not nervous at all. I think it's what's really important is we would like it to be screened perfectly, just the sound and the picture, for people to just, you know, relish, enjoy it, and ideally connect with it, you know, connect with it on a human level. Because truly what was Alice was describing earlier, I have my own definition of what happened, really, that after you generate so much energy and after so many false starts and you end up being in this position when you have to run for your life and make the movie no matter what, and it becomes just larger than life. It becomes that nonstop to be or not to be, give me liberty or give me death kind of situation. And we ran with it and we tried to make that movie and we tried to create this reality, recreate it and capture it. And these two waves of the reality resisting and us fighting for it, they clashed and they really gave birth to this amazing energy that miraculously got captured on film. So there is two aspects to it. There's the production aspect of it and there's metaphysical aspect to it. And I think that people who are open to this, the metaphysical side of this experience, will feel it and will laugh and will cry. We made this film for people to see, not just for our relatives, and not for intellectuals, not for classrooms. We want as many people, want it to be seen by as many people as possible over the world. We want world distribution for this film. We want it to come to Milwaukee through another door as a film distributed in Milwaukee by a reputable company, and we have a great chance of having that happen. So our hopes are that the film gets picked up at Sundance. And what happened with the film, the reason people in France, in Russia, in where else? I mean, in other places connect with it, it's a great sign. Why? Because they can relate to the local problems in Milwaukee. They can relate to the humanity that we captured. And
To the struggles. I agree with all that. I think the only thing I would add is that we did not set out to write anything political. We wrote this story, and the story is based on the city of Milwaukee, these characters in it, some experiences Kirill had when he first came here and actually drove Transit Express. But ultimately, the film is political insofar as it brings people together in a very divisive time. And it's about our common humanity.
Inadvertently,
and in a really magical, beautiful way and powerful way. And we've seen now people from all backgrounds, all cultures respond to that. And it's very timely, and I suppose arguably more timely now than it would have been when we first.
It
hit the zeitgeist, and that's. But I think it's something. I think another thing you talk about a lot is we really hope people will see it again and again, that it's the kind of thing that you need to watch and rewatch.
Which brings me to the topic of how it was made. It was made exactly in the spirit of how it is, because a few years ago, we didn't have money to rent space for auditions. We were driving through the website, and we were looking for spaces, and someone indicated the Wisconsin African-American Women's Center. We walked in and introduced ourselves to Josephine Hill, and she was absolutely puzzled by us. You know, who are these people? What are they doing in this area, this part of town, and what do they want from me? We explained what we wanted, what we needed, and she allowed us for the next 3 years to use the Wisconsin African American Women's Center for casting.
As a base.
Also as a base during the production, as a holding base. Free, absolutely. She never asked for a penny from us. And every time I would call her, yes, my dear, of course. And she was like, okay, well, you go make that movie. And every time she would see us day in, day out for 3 years, she never asked for a penny. And it's one of the,
We've since been able to give her a little bit back.
And actually, there's something a little more coming. But this is exactly the spirit of what we care.
Well, Josephine is one of the great unsung heroes in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. She does tremendous real work on the West Side for kids, for adults, for single parents, for, you know, college-bound young people. I mean, she's a remarkable person. And the Wisconsin African American Women's Center
completely
is
a completely overlooked place.
Totally under the radar place. And, you know, people talk a lot about the segregation in Milwaukee. We all know the problems in Milwaukee. And, you know, part of this process for us was just ignoring that and not being part of that. And we had a tremendous group of people from the West Side supporting the film and working on it and who are in it on camera, who are behind the scenes. And that was another important piece for us. So,
yeah, well, I definitely look forward to seeing what happens at Sundance and then hopefully it coming back around here so that we here in Milwaukee can see this film
Great.
As well. Thank you
Absolutely.
So much for coming in and talking about Give Me
Thank
Liberty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alice Austin is the writer and lead producer of the film Give Me Liberty. Kirill Mikhanovsky is the film's director, co-writer, and editor. The film has screened at Sundance, Cannes, and will now make its U.S. premiere here at the Oriental Theater on August 22nd. You can find more information about it at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then have an in-studio chat and performance with Wisconsin musician Keith Pulvermacher. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. At the end of 2018, singer-songwriter and Oconomowoc native Keith Pulvermacher released his latest album. 45 Story was recorded in Nashville, and it features a variety of musicians, including mandolin virtuoso Sam Bush. About a week after the album's release, Pulvermacher stopped by our studio solo for a chance to chat about his then-new record and to share a couple of tunes, including this one called Come On Back.
It's okay to lose your way. Just make sure you come on back. Hey! Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Come on back, Keith Pulvermacher in Lake Effect's Performance Studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What a great tune. And I was sitting there listening to it thinking, that is so true, and it's so hard to do.
Yeah.
To let yourself go off the tracks
right.
or to give yourself permission to do that or to forgive yourself for doing
forgiving
that.
Forgiving yourself, I think, is pretty tough.
Most of the songs on this album, the new album, 45 Story, they feel really, really personal, like this one. Where did they come from? What was the impetus for this?
I'm always writing, so this time around with this record, it really has been spurred on by the diagnosis of my dad having cancer and really looking internally at my own life and trying to see what I can do to make a difference in the world with the music and have more purpose. And really just so that people don't feel alone when they need help or aren't too proud to reach out for it or, you know, admit that they need it. I definitely do, you know. So, I mean, for me, it's been a just kind of cathartic way to try to achieve that through the music and make it mean more than just some self-absorbed songs, you know.
You know, about young love or whatever, which is great.
Right.
I mean, and the thing is, music plays that role in so many of our lives anyway, even if the songs aren't specifically about that, it's like we connect.
Well, it can, you know. I mean, there's room for everything, I think. You know, the fun songs are great, too. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from those or, you know, for me personally this time around, it just wasn't necessarily about, you know, writing fun music, you know. I might on the next one, you know, I might do something completely different. I don't know. I don't really dictate where it goes. Sometimes it just happens, and then I just pay attention to it, and then I write it when I feel something from it. That's typically what I do.
How long did it take to put this collection of songs together?
You know, there's a couple songs that I brought back that I wrote maybe 10 years ago. There's a song called What It Is to Live. There's some songs I wish were on the record that I haven't recorded yet. Well, I have recorded, but just didn't make it on the record. I mean, typically we record a couple more songs and then take them off, but I was traveling back and forth to Nashville, so I had to be kind of a little bit more efficient.
Okay, yeah. So I was going to ask you where the recording happened. So are you doing most of the recording in Nashville now or just for this album?
Yes, I did most of the recording in Nashville. I almost missed the plane The whole project has been so close to catastrophe, like from the CD release party to the first session we had was here in Milwaukee, and it was the day after Christmas last year, and I got a phone call from my tenant who's in my duplex, and she was like, well, I think the pipes are leaking because I can hear it spraying in the walls. And I'm like, oh, they're not leaking. I had probably 10 people in the studio, you know, people in from out of town, and my producer was up from Nashville because he's from here originally. He was visiting family. We thought we'd kill two birds with one stone. And so I had to can the session, and then I had to be on the plane. I had another session booked in Nashville, and the plane was boarding at 6:15, and I woke up at 5:19 in Oconomowoc, and I was like, I started shaking, and I drove down there in like 95 miles an hour, blew past a cop. He didn't pull me over. I was like, well, maybe that's a sign. I mean, it was like 20 below zero, and I got three guitars, a suitcase, and my backpack, and I'm like walking, dragging all this stuff through the parking structure to the gate, and like the woman's like, you're going to miss your plane. I'm like, I can't miss the plane. It's going to be a $10,000 mistake if I miss a plane. So I walk on the plane with my shoes, and I'm shaking, and my hands are all crippled up from being dehydrated, and I can't breathe, and I'm like... I mean, it had to be. I wish somebody had it on video because it just had to be something to be seen. It was chaotic.
But you made it.
I did with 3 minutes left. And my keyboard player is sitting there with a Bloody Mary. He's like, you good?
I will be if I have a Bloody Mary. Yeah. And I assume all the guitars made it and everything made it.
And I just got some new guitar cases too, so they didn't have my name on there. And I've got the longest name in the world, and I'm from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. And I'm like trying to write it out, and everything looks like I'm written by Santa because I'm shaking so bad.
So it only could go uphill from downhill, maybe.
I wrote a song called I Know I'm Gonna Make It because it's all downhill from here. But that's besides the point. It's not on the record either. But no, when I got – it was actually – by the time Downbeat happened, because we had everything booked on Music Row, had the engineer there, I had to hire a drummer because my drummer was all busted up at the time. And so Dan Needham was down there playing drums. And so I had the engineer and video people down there. So if I would have missed – because that was the day we were tracking all the bed tracks. And if I didn't get those bed tracks, the rest of the week I was down there to do all the overdubs and all the repairs and all the guitar work and all the – you know, pull all the scratch tracks out. And for people who don't know what I'm talking about, you lay down the drums and the bass first and the keys first. And you want to get really, really good bed tracks. So that's the foundation of the songs, you know. And then you go in and you do everything else, the vocals and the guitars and any other, you know – colorful instruments that you're going to add on top of that. But if those bed tracks aren't laid,
you got nothing.
Nothing to build on.
Right.
You know, so that would have been, that would have cost me $10,000. So yeah, that 3 minutes was really, really valuable to me. It's super valuable for sure.
Oh, well, we're going to go back to this album, but I am looking forward to the next album when you write about all of that.
That's going to be a punk record.
There's got to be. There's got to be something in there where you're just thrashing.
Yeah, I do. I definitely got a little of that in me, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can throw it off the rails a couple times.
Yes, which I think would be a lot of fun. A lot of fun. But the record got made, obviously,
yes,
because the CD release party, by the time this airs, the CD release party will have happened at Collectivo Backroom. Is that right?
Yes, it's actually happening tonight. So if you hear this next week, come last week.
Yeah. Go back in time. Yeah. And, you know, I've been watching a lot of Doctor Who reruns. So, you know, we could adjust.
Happen.
Yeah,
sure.
It could happen.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We'll just ask, you know, Peter Capaldi or whoever, you know, to do that for us. But seriously, the album will be out officially.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming folks can get it on your website.
You can go to my website. I am going to put it on iTunes and Spotify, I think. I'm just like trying to strategize what the best way to do it is, just because I'm kind of against those things just because they take so much off the top. But it's also the
other
way.
And don't give much back to the musicians.
Yeah, but I mean, it's you just got to give in. I mean, my pride isn't bigger than the business, you know. So I'm eventually just going to have to surrender, unless somebody just miraculously picks me up and I become Elvis Presley overnight, which I don't foresee happening.
No, and you know, I don't think the white suit would look good.
No, not anymore. Maybe when I was 19 or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm 22 now. So,
exactly. Yeah. You know, it's way too old.
Well, before we get into more about the album, let's hear another tune from it.
Okay.
What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play The Fog. When the fog comes rolling in, can't see where I've been and where I'm going. I've been keeping my head down, looking at the ground below my feet. When the dreams all disappear, like the past, it isn't clear, no way of knowing which direction I should take. Faith is all that's left here to guide me. Well, I've learned a thing or two, but now my vision isn't what it used to be. And I get lost again every now and then. When the fog comes rolling in, some faces seem familiar, but time has changed the places I have known. I know everyone is in the dark sometimes, so when I feel alone, try to scream a little louder, so maybe someone out there hears my voice. And I get lost again every now and then. When the fog comes rolling in. Can't see my way, I listen and I pray, so maybe I feel signs in the dark, and I'll find my way again every now and then. When the fog comes rolling in, when the fog comes rolling in, when the fog comes rolling in.
Keith Pulvermacher in Lake Effects Performance Studio with The Fog from his brand new album, 45 Story. Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
The album, you talked about one of the things you wanted to do with this is give back and to let people know that they weren't alone. And there's another aspect, though, to the album that you kind of took it another step by giving songs away. So explain to me what that is and how that's working.
I say a lot of stuff on Facebook or, you know, I'm pretty passionate about what I feel, and I don't want to make it political. Being a decent human being has become political. I mean, it's just ridiculous to me. So I say things, and then people think I'm divisive if I don't stand on their side of the fence. To me, it's kind of like walking the walk and talking the talk. And the philanthropic end of it is I feel I've been given a gift, and I feel like people who have these blessings, whether it's financial gain or smart or talented, we have a responsibility to to take care of each other. And now some people do it and some people don't, but what I want to do is I want to lead by example.
Well, Keith, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Best of luck.
Thank
I
you.
Hope you'll come back and tell us how it goes. 6 months to a year, let us know.
Yeah, I mean,
who's on board? Maybe bring some musicians in.
That'd be great. I mean, my band is killer. I got some friends who came in from Nashville to play with me tonight, and so I'm going to do that some more. And I'd like to get out on the road a little bit and touring. I just signed with a manager in New York a couple weeks ago, and so
congratulations.
Thank
on
you.
That.
Thank yep. Yeah, I've known her for a long time, and so it's just another, you know, you can only talk for yourself so much, and people don't listen, you know, and then you're like, no, I just needed to start pulling on this network of people that I've had for years and years and years, and I just didn't ever tap into it. You know, I was just like, well, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. But now it's definitely need to go to the next place. And now's the time. I mean, you know, 45 story is like, what am I going to do with my time while I got this? You know, what if I, you know, I could get sick. I could, something could happen. And then did I capitalize on my opportunity, or did I let it go away because I was afraid of failure? You know, it's stupid.
getting back to that, don't be afraid to let it go off the tracks a little bit.
Yeah, I won't.
Yeah,
I'll probably drive it into the tunnel.
Exactly.
I'll drive it in the mountain.
Like, oh no. Tracks? What tracks? I needed tracks for this?
I just don't have anything left because I'm on fire now.
Well, bring the band next time.
Awesome.
Love to hear the full thing. And I'm hoping you'll take us out with the song.
Yes.
That is the giving, the kind of the catalyst for this new way of thinking about how to help people.
Yeah, that's great. I'd be happy to. And thank you again for having me on the show.
Keith Pulvermacher recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio back in January. He had just released his latest album, 45 Story. Our in-studio performance was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
If you need someone to call, someone to catch you if you fall, if you need somewhere to go where you can be yourself, you know. There are times when I feel helpless, times when I need someone to. I will be your comfort, I will be your strength, I will be forgiveness, even if my own heart breaks. I will just be love, when all you need is love, it's true. I will always be here for you.